All right, so welcome back, everybody.
Good to be back.
So for those that didn't come back...
Lolly, did I not email you back? You emailed me.
I don't think so, but...
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I understood why
really,
you... Whatever, it was
okay,
all good.
Okay, thank you.
It's all good. I understood why you did. I could relate.
Okay,
so for those that didn't come back, the official reason is that they got all the answers they needed last time. They're good to go. Now one fellow's ill. Here they come.
Okay.
All right. So this is our relationship seminar part two. And I'm going to open up with a little bit left field. You'll have to bear with me for a second. This week's Torah portion, we read about... construction of the Mishkan, the portable temple that accompanied the Jews in the desert. It so happens to be that these days, those that study the Maimonides Magnum Opus, the Yad HaChazakah, 14 volumes of Maimonides, which is a cycle that the Rebbe established to study three chapters a day, and in doing so you complete the entire book of Maimonides about every 10 and a half, 11 months. So these days we're studying the laws of the temple in Jerusalem. And today, in the third chapter of today's section, I want to read the following two laws. First one goes like this. It is a positive commandment to fear the place of God's holiness, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Shenemar, as it is written, Umikdashi tira'u, and you should fear from my holy place. But of course, you're not fearing the holy place itself, but the one who commanded regarding the fear of the holy place. In other words, who are we really in awe of? We're in awe of God, not the physical space, but we're in awe of God. And then Maimonides, the Rambam, continues, and he says, what is considered fear? What is considered awe? How are you in fear or in awe of the place of the Beit HaMikdash? So he says as follows, one should not ascend the temple mount with their staff or with their shoes upon their feet. Or they had certain garments, I guess it would be maybe like a headband, something that the handkerchief that they would use to wipe their sweat, or with the dirt upon your feet, or with your money tied up in a sack, like they used to carry, you know, their money hanging over their back. And surely it's prohibited to spit on the Temple Mount. One should not use the Temple Mount as a shortcut, etc. Now, why am I telling you this? Because in marriage, there are two fundamental ingredients to ensuring that a marriage remains not just intact, but active. That the relationship is an active one. I'll come back to this point in a minute. A relationship is built on that which we do for each other. Right? What we do for each other is what a relationship is built on. You can't say, oh, I'm in love with this person, and I never bring them flowers, I never bring them gifts, I never help out around the house, I never help with the kids, but I love them. How do you know that I love them? Because I never say nasty things to them, or I'm never unfaithful to them, or, right? A relationship is not built on what we don't do, a relationship is built on what we do do. That's what creates the connection between two people, is what they do for each other, what they do together. However, a relationship that's only built on what we do, the positive actions, but there is no fear, or in common terms, respect, which gets manifest in what we don't do, is a relationship that's going to fall apart very quickly. In other words, just as you have the person who says, I love the person, but I don't do anything, you can have the person who does plenty of positive, but also is constantly violating the relationship. Not necessarily with infidelity, but violating the relationship. They're not nice to the other person. They're constantly doing the things that the other person dislikes, right? The other person dislikes, they're constantly doing those things. So a relationship requires two things, love and fear, love and respect. Love is the glue that makes the relationship. Respect or awe is defined by that which we do not do. So in the case of the law that I just read to you from Maimonides, how do you fear? How are you in awe of the place of the temple? Maimonides doesn't mention one positive action. He talks all about negative actions. Don't go onto the mountain with your shoes. Don't spit on the mountain. Don't use it as a shortcut, right? Because respect is built on what we don't do. That's not enough to make a relationship, but it's an absolute necessity. What makes a relationship is the positive things that we do for each other. So, bringing it to our conversation, in a marriage, love is manifest in all the things that we do, many of which we'll talk about tonight, but it's from the most basic of household chores to the sensitive things that one does for the one that they love, male to female, female to male, in terms of gifts that we buy each other, thoughtful things that we do for each other. Again, thoughtful things doesn't mean that you have to go out of your way. Just simply in the home, in the relationship, you're interacting, you're sensitive to what the other person wants, and you make sure to do those things. That's what the relationship, that's a manifestation of love. Respect is a sensitivity that when your spouse doesn't want you to do something, doesn't want you to talk about a particular subject, doesn't want you to act in a certain way, doesn't want you to behave in a certain way, doesn't want you to associate perhaps outside of the home in a certain way, for whatever reason. Again, there's room for conversation for all of this, but the premise is, you don't want me to do something, I respect you enough that I'm not going to do those things that you don't want me to do. Good?
Good. Yes. So just going further, more practically on what he's saying, let's just go deeper. So relationships are built on security and safety. You have to feel safer in a relationship, right? You have to feel like this person's got my back. This person is always going to be there to look out for me. And then there's the you know, we live in this country where it's all based upon life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So the question is, how are we happy in a relationship? Well, as adults, I think we can figure out that, and sometimes it takes people years to figure this out, but really, you need to make yourself happy. You have to do things as an adult to make yourself happy, and then together, you and your spouse can be happy to on this journey in a relationship together. But if you are going to constantly look at your other half to make you happy, like baseline is I'm blah, and only when he walks in the door, and only when he remembers my birthday, and only when he does this for me, and only when he remembers not to do that, am I going to go up and be happy? You're never going to be happy. So, and I think it takes a few years to figure this out, that like, you know, you go on vacation together and you're at the beach or whatever, and you say, and you really want to go to the beach, but you say to your husband, like, what should we do today? Maybe you should just say, I want to go to the beach today, or I'm going to the beach today. We're at the beach, right? But he wants to go horseback riding because that brochure that when you came in had horseback riding, you know, 2 miles away from the beach. And you're like, no, I want to go to the beach. So you should go to the beach. You should get your manicures. You should take men like to watch their games. They should watch their games. They should get, you know, they should take it. They should go play volleyball with their friends. Do those things in a respectful manner, not during dinner time and not at the expense of someone else. But we're adults. We all have our own time. And even if we work all day and that would take into family time. So you have to carve out, you each have to speak to each other about that time for yourself. But everyone is in charge of their own happiness in a relationship. And then together you can be happy. So I have a relative and she does Feldenkrais, and this is it's a type of therapy which is based in Israel, and it works on the bone structure as opposed to like therapists
occupational therapists, which work on more on the muscles. And she specializes in young children, and she says that like mothers come in and she deals with kids that have cerebral palsy and autism and like really severe, and they're not potty training correctly, and she's teaching them more anatomically how to walk and how to be. And she says like the mother's faces are like this, you know, their eyebrows are furrowed, and she's like, could you imagine your baby's looking at you all? You're looking at your baby like that? So that's how they see themselves. They see themselves with eyebrows furrowed, and they see all this negativity based on them. And that's this, it says, Kemayim panim el panim kein lev ha'adam el adam. Just as you look at your reflection in water, that's how another person sees you. So if you're constantly negative towards somebody, if you're constantly critical towards them, if they never measure up, that's how they're going to see themselves. That's how they're going to be. And, you know, at the beginning I said we're all adults. You say, well, you're responsible for your own happiness. Well, then be responsible for your own misery, or be happy anyway. Even we're adults. We can understand this, that, you know, the way you treat your spouse, that is how they will act. They will rise to the occasion. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So women, because I'm always speaking to the women, they say there's studies that show that women who are supportive, their husbands do better at work. They get promotions. There's a famous NFL player I don't know who it is, I just read this anecdote, but he got less injuries than his teammates. And he said, because when I go out to the field, my wife's not nagging me. She's not pulling me and saying, no, why are you still in this field? I hate that you go out. She believes in me. She knows I'm strong. She knows I can handle myself. And you know what? It translates into less injuries for him. So when we believe in somebody, then they actually can rise to the occasion. So pretend to love your husband more than your children. Yeah. What I'm saying here is that many of us respect, we're in a relationship with our spouses, and then it kind of flips when we have children, and even later, like everything's for the children, and we are like, go get it, the kids are coming, make dinner, it's for the, and like, what's backwards about this? It should be mom's coming, dad's coming, mom needs a place, dad needs a place. We flip the relationship. We give all this respect to our children, and we make our spouse the shmata. Like, we make them the secondary character, because the baby, you know, it starts so young. Like, the baby needs to eat. Like, you know, no. So maybe my spouse needs to eat, or maybe I need to eat. Like, and what you're doing by respecting your spouse more, let's say, than your children, then that reflects great on the children too. Then they start seeing that, oh wow, this is a respectful relationship, and they start respecting their parents. So this is something that just breeds contentment and breeds a good family. Criticizing each other, you know, you might say, if you know, a husband comes home and he's in a bad mood, or I'm looking at you, you all have older kids, let's say, and you guys will have kids, please God, one day. But if you're, you know, on the phone with your kids and you're like, oh my God, dad, you know, whatever, since he retired, he's puttering around the house, and I don't know what to do with him, whatever, like you're criticizing whatever it is, right? And you think you're giving, like, you're explaining, you're being nice, because you're defending kind of your spouse to your children, but really you're not. Like, you don't need to put down your spouse to your children. Think of nice things to say, and that will raise your spouse in their own image, and they will live up to that image that you have of them, very much like children, very much like anyone we're in a relationship. How you view that person is how they're going to come to that relationship. That's how they're going to perform for you. So if you are in a funk, you know, and this could be like a months-long funk, or a years-long funk, or days, or weeks, however this funk affects you, and you're like, no, I just can't respect this person. Whatever, everything he does is just the pits, and you've got to dig deep. You know, if you want to say, oh, I wish, you know, the woman last week, she said she wished her husband got a better job, and all she really wanted was clothing. So he doesn't take care of me. Like, oh, like he doesn't, when's the last time we went on vacation? He hasn't bought me anything, and he never helps with the kids, whatever. And then you're like, no, I need to stop this. I need to get out of it. So like, you know, who pays the mortgage every single month? every single month, or who pays the car bills, or who goes to a job they can't stand just to make ends meet in your family. Like, you just got to dig deep and find things and kind of fake it till you make it, because in faking it, you're helping your spouse be better at who they are, because you're giving them a smile and you're giving them encouragement and you're giving them positivity. And that's the same thing with our children when they're going through a funk. Like, we just stay positive for them. We keep believing in them. We'd be shooting ourselves in the foot to not believe in our spouse or our children. Don't confuse, honesty with criticism. Like, you can say, like, I was just being honest. You asked me if the shirt looked nice. It just looks ugly. Yeah. You don't have to be so honest, okay? So really, marriage is the place to grow for yourself. It's the best place. I think we spoke about this last week. It's the place where, when you're struggling in your marriage, you got to look inward. It's not about the other person. I think we said it last week, unless they're abusive or alcoholic or cannot stay faithful, when you're struggling in a marriage, in this kind of relationship, you've got to look inside yourself deeply. There was one other thing that I thought of. I'll think about it in a second. Did you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to repeat all of those things that Dina just mentioned. But I'm going to present them from the man's perspective. So she was talking to the women. I'm going to talk to the men. You can listen in, women. So only we are in charge of our happiness. And I'm going to add that we are not in charge of our spouse's happiness. We can make somebody's life miserable, but we can't make them happy. And it's not your responsibility to make them happy. Judaism is about responsibilities. If you've been coming to classes here, you've heard that before. It's about obligations. The Torah tells us what our obligations are, what our responsibilities. It's not multiple choice, and it's not optional, and it's not a right. They're responsibilities. So the responsibilities of love and respect are responsibilities. They sometimes will help your spouse have happiness, but not always. Because happiness is not always, and it's mostly not dependent on others. It's from within. And if you're going to take it as your responsibility to make your spouse happy, if that's the foundation for your marriage, we're in trouble. Especially if you have a wife who's not so happy. Got that?
It's radical.
Huh?
Radical.
It's radical. So if you think it's radical, let's dig for a second a little deeper. Because sometimes when you take the responsibility, when you define the happiness of your marriage by the happiness of your spouse, you're going to be continuously frustrated if you have an unhappy spouse. It doesn't mean that they're not happy in the marriage. They're just unhappy. It could be a phase in their life. It could be they're an unhappy person. Doesn't mean you can't love them. Doesn't mean you don't have a wonderful marriage. But if you're going to define the success of your marriage by the happiness of your spouse, you're going to be in trouble. And you're not looking at your role properly, which is, what are my responsibilities?
But you're not saying not to do things that make your spouse happy.
No, absolutely do the things that make your spouse happy. I should have started with what Dina's point last week, is that the nature of men is to want to bring their spouse pleasure, to bring their wife pleasure. That's what we want to do. That's what makes us feel worthy in a relationship. And hopefully that will help them be happy. But it doesn't always. That's not in our... We don't have the ability to ensure that our actions are going to translate into their happiness.
Right, and that's why women and men need to be in charge of their own happiness.
So that was one point. The next point was that Dina made was the idea of how we look at someone is how it gets reflected. In other words, how you look at the others, how it's going to become reflected back on you. And if your spouse is unhappy, and you're unhappy because they're unhappy, you don't help the situation. You exacerbate the situation. In other words, just because one person, and this doesn't necessarily have to be about happiness, we all have our moments where we're in a mood, right? And if your spouse is in a mood, and because they're in a mood, you're going to say, well, I can't be happy and I can't be upbeat if you're miserable. Well, that's not going to help the situation. You know, sometimes people come into a room and somebody's in a bad mood, so it kind of sets this negative energy on the room. And we almost blame the other person that because you're in a bad mood, therefore there's this unpleasantness in the room. But that doesn't help anybody, because all you do is you exacerbate the situation. So when you come into the home, you come into the environment, and one spouse is unhappy or in a bad mood, don't join the mood. And you're not obligated to join the mood. It's okay for you to be happy and to be upbeat. Doesn't mean you have to do things specifically to irritate them. But just because they're in a mood doesn't mean you have to also be in a mood. Be yourself. Be upbeat. There's no violation of the relationship when you do that. And on the contrary, it helps the other person. You create a more positive environment so they can come out of that mood. You know, when we talk about obligations, we all wake up in the morning sometimes not in the mood. Not in the mood of the marriage. I don't mean of being married. It's like, I'm just not in the mood. You know? Just leave me alone. Sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're not in the mood of your kids either. It's like, maybe you can disappear for a day or two, right?
You need a vacation.
It's a good sign you need a vacation. But you don't get...
Was it recording?
It was recording, yeah. It'll be in parts. So you don't get to check out of the relationship, just like you can't turn in your parent card. I mean, you could, but those are not really good people who, when they wake up in the mood in the morning and they just don't want their kids anymore, you know, drop them off somewhere, right? You can't unload your kids just because today you're not in the mood of being a parent. Doesn't mean that you're not entitled to find your space in that, but you can't just turn in your parent card because you're not in the mood, because your kid's getting on your nerves. Whether it's their fault or not, sometimes it's completely their fault. Still, you just can't check out. And the same thing is true in a marriage. Just because you wake up in the morning and you're not in the mood of being married, you don't get to check out. And therefore, because you don't get to check out, it means you still have to do your responsibilities. In other words, you may not be feeling strong love today. You definitely must maintain your respect. You must maintain your respect. You may not do as much on the love side when you're not in the mood. And that's okay, as long as you don't stay in that mood for too long. Now, what happens when you're finding that you're seeing a lot of negative in your spouse? And what begins to happen is, it happens in different stages in life. We read this article about, from a blog, about this woman writing, it was a man writing to his wife, I think, about telling his wife that now is not the time to get divorced. Right in the middle of this period of time when we're in the throes of raising our adolescents and teenagers. Right? In other words, life is crazy. And because life is crazy, you lose your perspective. You're caught up in other stuff. You're not caught up in your relationship. You have to make time for a relationship. We'll talk about some of those tips soon. But you're not caught up in your relationship because you're caught up in all this other stuff. And what happens when you're caught up in other stuff, your perspective of your spouse can take on a form that's not entirely healthy. And that's where the last point Dina made, which is that marriage is all about self-work. It's when things are rough that you have to pause and try to dig deep and try to find the positive qualities It's easy to look at the negative when you're in a negative space. And it's easy to only see the negative when you're in a negative space, because those are your glasses that you put on. And some of that negativity is substantiated. But we all have negativity. And that's not what the relationship was ever built on. It was built on the positive qualities of the other. But we're not bothering to look at that. There's a classic story of this guy who hates his wife, and he will not give her the pleasure, though, of a divorce. So he comes to the rabbi, and he says, "Rabbi, I got a predicament. Can't stand my wife. I want her out of the picture, but I'm not going to give her the pleasure of a divorce. So what do I do?" So the rabbi said, it says in the Talmud that somebody who makes a pledge to charity and doesn't make good on the pledge, their spouse will die on them. So make a pledge to the synagogue. There's a capital campaign going on. Make a pledge and don't fulfill the pledge. And so he comes into the synagogue. There's a meeting and they're raising money, and he raises his hand. "I'm going to give $100,000. Oh, everybody's so happy. They publicize it. And he starts coming home every day, and he's hoping to see his wife dead. And he's in a great mood. No, so he keeps on coming in, and he keeps on, every time he's expecting to see his wife dead, you know, she's sleeping, he's listening, is she really alive? She's still alive. He comes to the rabbi after a couple of weeks of this, and he says, it's not working. So he says, you have to pretend she's on to you. She knows you got something going here, so she's protecting herself however she's doing that. You need to pretend that you love her. She has to think that everything is good. So you have to pretend that you love her." So he says, "How do I do this?" He said, "I'll bring her flowers and make her coffee in the morning." So he starts doing all of these things. And as he starts doing all of these positive actions, he suddenly realizes, "Hey, this is the woman I married. She's beautiful. She's wonderful. I don't want her to die." Whoa, what's going on here? He runs back to the rabbi and he says, "Now we're in trouble here. I mean, I love her. I realize why I married her. What are we going to do about this?" The rabbi says, "Well, there's only one choice. You got to make good on your pledge." So what's the moral of the story? Is that when we're young, when we start a relationship, we have only positive glasses on. And then as life...
Or we wouldn't have married each other.
Exactly. And then as life goes on, the negativity creeps in. And if we stay focused on the negativity, then that becomes the reality. And you all know, and we know people who got stuck on the negativity. They had wonderful relationships, but they got stuck on the negativity and they were never able to climb out of it, and it ended in divorce. It doesn't have to be that way. It's a choice that we make. It's a choice that we make what we're going to do and how we're going to perceive the other person. And it doesn't happen on its own. It's effort. It's self-improvement. It's a lot of work. It's a choice you make when you wake up in that morning and you're not in the mood to decide that I'm going to find 5 positive things to say to my wife today. I'm going to find 5 positive things to say to my husband today. I'm going to do 3 positive actions. I'm going to do things that demonstrate the positivity. And as the great scholar, the author of the Chinuch, which is a commentary on the commandments of the Torah, says that Achrei hapu'ulais halavavis nimshachis, after the actions, the heart is drawn. It's like the old shift cars, right? What happened when it didn't start? You'd start pushing it down a hill and the engine would kick in, right? So sometimes that's the way it works. If you want the heart to come out, it will follow the actions. Do the actions that demonstrate love, and the heart will follow in the same way.
So we're going to talk about intimacy next, but I just want to say that there's intimacy, which is physical intimacy, but then there's things that kind of, the first thing I said tonight was talking about the safety in a relationship. So when we're critical, we create a friction in the intimacy. Nobody feels like they want to be close to somebody who's been judging them or who said nice things to them. So that, when we're, you know, everybody knows that men don't like to ask for directions. They don't like to take directions. They just like to figure out everything for themselves. And women are always giving their husband directions, and we're always telling them how to go. We're always telling them the better route, and they didn't do it fast. And what are we gaining? We're getting there 2 minutes earlier. We put up a wall to get somewhere 2 minutes earlier. Does that make any sense? 30 minutes earlier. Leave it. Like, these are the things that they create
barriers.
What?
Barriers.
Barriers in our intimacy when we're critical of the other. So you have to weigh, is this worth it? And it's not that you're giving in to somebody, and it's not that you're being less than. You're taking the high road. You're like, I don't need to point out everything, and I don't need to be critical about everything. And you know, your spouse probably knows already. And then and if you don't give them directions 10 times, maybe one time they'll ask you for directions when you actually need to get somewhere quicker. The world that we live in for the past hundreds of years is a very Christian world. This country is based on Judeo-Christian values, right? Supposedly. But really, our entire world has been painted, or the Western world, with this brush of Christianity. And the way Christianity views intimacy, sexuality, they view it as a necessary means to an end. But if you look at the highest members of the church, they are celibate, right? They are not involved in intimacy, because obviously it's not a very good thing. It's dirty. It's unacceptable. And this is the world view. And this is kind of, even if you grew up in a Jewish home, you see the world, even as sexualized as our world is, there's still this underlying idea that it is dirty, that it is bad. And that's not a Jewish message at all. According to Judaism, when a husband and wife are together, al taharat hakodesh, in purity, and we'll talk about that, I'm not going to go into the details of it, but when a husband and wife are together appropriately, they're together in a meaningful way, that there is nothing holier than you could be doing as a human being. And you're actually doing the only thing that we can do to be most godlike, is to be intimate, because a potential of that is a child. And even though we're intimate way more times than children we're going to have, but it's still, you're creating something. You are bonding together. And that, according to Judaism, is the highest level you can reach. The Kohen would go to the mikvah 7 times before he went into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. A woman goes into the mikvah before she is intimate. So that's, you already see that the mikvah represents, if something goes into the mikvah, it's changing. It's getting ready for something very special and very holy. So that is something that tells us that. And So what does it mean, an appropriate way? So a husband and wife to be together, it's in Judaism, it's like you have this different vision than the rest of the world, but yet we also have different rules than the rest of the world, right? Because you're not just going to, if it was the best thing in the world and it's a free-for-all, well, we'd look like America looks today, which, by the way, we look like that. But, you know, you can't have it always. So, in order for intimacy to be the most spiritual, holy, wonderful thing that it is, it requires there to be a marriage, and it requires a mikvah, and it requires a separating and then a coming back together. And just that whole rhythm, which we're not going to get into in this class, but if anyone wants to talk about that, that whole rhythm of intimacy is on a very practical level also contributes to relationship, because if you're not always available to each other, if you're not always there for each other and not by your own accord. It's not because I'm not in the mood. It's not because I'm disinterested right now. It's not because I'm too tired or have a headache, but this is not our time together. It allows for everybody to separate, have their own space, have their own time. If we're not only thinking about the physical, then we can think about, do we talk to each other? Do we know each other? Do we have a relationship besides for that? And that contributes, with all things being equal, if everybody's working on their relationship and everybody's trying to make themselves happy and everybody's giving and everybody's loving and everyone's respecting and everybody feels safe, then having this component just adds a more deep and loving and exciting component to a relationship.
Yeah, I'm going to just add a few comments on some of the stuff that Dina mentioned. So first of all, just to elaborate a little bit on the distinction between Judaism and Christianity and other faiths and other religions and other schools of thought, focus on the Judaism part. Many religions see God as contradictory to physicality. In other words, God is limited in the sense that God is a spiritual being. Judaism, and particularly according to Jewish mysticism and Hasidic philosophy, God, while God is transcendent, the paradox of God is that as transcendent as God is, he's found in the physical details. And that's God's greatness. When we say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, here was your Lord God, the Lord is one. One indicates that there's two. Instead of saying God is singular, we say God is one. God is singular would be all-encompassing. There is only one God. But when we say God is one, that means there's space for two. The reason why we use that terminology is because God's greatness is that God can be found in many. The same one God is found within the dichotomy and within the many. So God's greatness is not only that God is a transcendent God, but that God permeates into the physical world. And the more physical it is, and the more, we can say, the base it is, not unholy, but the more base it is, the more really physical and coarse it is, that's the greatest opportunity to manifest godliness. So in this action, which I think we can all agree that in terms of physical human desire and pleasure, it's the most base, it's the most basic of human experiences, when it's done properly, then it's the most godly. Because, so to speak, it's a place that you would never think God is there, but God is even found there. So what does that mean that it's holy? So let's just bring one other fascinating idea from the Midrash. So where's the holiest place on earth? Don't be shy.
The Temple Mount.
The Temple Mount. And within the Temple Mount itself, there was the place of the temple. There was the Holy of Holies, where the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, Dina mentioned, went in only once a year on Yom Kippur. In the Holy of Holies, there was an ark. And on top of the ark, there were cherubs, keruvim. And the Midrash tells us that when the Romans came in to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, to destroy the temple, they came in to the Holy of Holies, and they saw these two cherubs, one a male and one a female, and their positions were one of intimacy. And they took it out in the street and they paraded it around and it said, see what these people worship? These are animalistic people. So what's really going on here? The idea is that intimacy is the most intimate manifestation of our relationship with God. And there is no place where that gets more expressed than in the Holy of Holies, when it's done correctly, when it's done right. So what does it mean that it's done right? So, to dispel a bunch of myths and notions just within the basic concept, that is that intimacy, by definition, means that there's no barriers. You give of your very self to the other, which means that there cannot be any separation. Not just physical separation, no clothing, there's nothing physical that separates between the two, but also emotional separations. Maimonides, and it's brought down in the Code of Jewish Law, is that we're not allowed to be intimate when somebody's angry. You're not allowed to be intimate when somebody's asleep. You're not allowed to be intimate when somebody's drunk. Because when somebody is in any of these altered states, they're not fully present to give fully of themselves. There's something separating between the two. And that defeats the purpose. Then it's not holy anymore. So for it to be holy, it needs to be giving, completely exposed, and not focused on self, but focused on the other. When we're interested in bringing the other pleasure, then even if there's no physical separations, no emotional separations, whatever is the self is being given outward, it's giving to the other, it's being given to the other. And when that's the reality, then you've created the perfect environment for selflessness, for holiness, to then be born out of this union. So I mentioned this in the last class, and then we'll have some final thoughts, and then we'll take some questions, that in terms of relationships, the physical dimension of a relationship, maybe 50% of the equation. The physical attraction, the pleasantness of the other person's company. And I would say that maybe physical intimacy is also 50% of the relationship. And that part of it is yes or no. You either have it or you don't have it. The success of that 50% is going to be completely dependent on the other 50%. How we treat each other, our sensitivity towards the other, our respect for the other, how we work on ourselves in how we want to perceive the other, how we go out of our way when we're not in the mood. All of that, and like our story, right, when the person is acting in a way that's giving and loving, it raises the attractiveness of the other person. And by the way, it raises your attractiveness as well. You become more appealing when you're pleasant and happy and upbeat and giving and positive. You just become a more interesting and more pleasant person to want to be around. So the self-fulfilling prophecy, you want to be in a wonderful marriage, be wonderful. You want your spouse to be beautiful and handsome and wonderful and giving and loving, you do that. Because that will awaken a response in them when you're acting that way. And then that keeps on feeding itself to a beautiful relationship. So let's take questions. We have 15 minutes. Questions.
It's such an important topic, what we're talking about, and I saw the advertisement in the Jewish Times, and I thought there'd be like dozens of people, and it's so appropriate whether you're currently in a relationship or not. So it plays to so many people. Why are we so too busy to pay attention to what we're talking about? I mean, taking the time basically to think about that which is so important. Any thoughts?
It's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Adlawi said last week. Like, you guys get 100% for being, you know, for showing up, for wanting to invest. I don't know. We had hoped, you know, parents would come, because parents would hear things while they're raising their kids in their early years and think about it for later, but maybe they're, I don't know.
I'll say two things. Number one, I think that, like everything else, I think people want a lot out of marriage, but we live in a society that everything is disposable. And we also live in a society that we want things to be easy. And life is busy. And oftentimes we don't make the time for the things that we need to until it's too late. So I think all of those are factors that we deal with in our society. But on the other hand, two things. One, we need to create time within our own relationships. Other than showing up to a class, which is definitely important, we have to make time within our relationships to work on our relationships. Not in passing, and not when there's a problem, but to make times consciously to work on a relationship. Nothing good, no investment that you really want a good return just happens on its own. So dedicating one evening a week where you go out to spend time together, and that it could be enjoyable time, but it also needs to be meaningful time. It's an opportunity to talk about your relationship. It's not going to happen on its own. It can't happen when somebody comes home at the end of the day and is frustrated, and then there's a blow up, and that becomes the platform for talking about the relationship. It is, and it does, and positive things oftentimes are born out of that, but that's not called working on your relationship. Working on your relationship is when there isn't a crisis, that you take the time to talk about the real things. And the second point is that we need to be a light unto others about everything in life. If you're a good parent, you model that for other parents, and they'll learn from you. If you're a good student, if you're passionate about learning about Judaism, you're doing that as a model for other people around you. If you're generous, if you're, you know, philanthropic, whatever, the more positive we do, and we're not afraid to show it. So if somebody says to you, you guys look like you have a wonderful marriage, then say, we invest in it. We go to classes. We take the time. You have no idea how that's going to affect someone. Someone hears that in passing, and they say, you know, maybe I should do something like that. So it's important to model that for other people. That's how we affect society. You know, maybe we can't conquer the whole world, but if you impact one person's life, our sages say you save one life, you save a world. You save one marriage, you save a world.
So, yeah, this is my question, actually. So you can build those wonderful relations with anyone, or it's also about meeting a right person?
So meeting the right person is actually not in your, it's not in your control, really. You have to, what you can control is,
Want me to talk?
Yeah. Sorry. I got bad hip right now. Okay, so meeting, you don't have control over finding the right person that God has to help you with, but you can do all the right things. You can date, you can make yourself look beautiful, you can be working on yourself, you have to do all those things, but it's not really in your control. What's in your control is when people come your way, is to have the tools to know how to tell if they're an upstanding person, if they're going to treat you well, and to not think, oh my God, he's so gorgeous and he makes so much money, I'm marrying him. You know, is what's in your control is to say, I'm not going to be, he might be gorgeous and have money, and he might be the nicest person in the world. Lucky you, that's great. You know, go for it. But what's in your control is to be able to differentiate and to choose wisely. But ultimately, your soulmate needs to find its way to you. Say that, but you have to be on alert. You can't be snoozing in bed, but you have to be looking for them, and you have to be active. But that is faith in God, prayer, networking. That's, you got to do that work. But there's no, the tips for finding the right person is being self-aware, and again, working on yourself. The more you know yourself, the more confident you are, the more you're going to be able to walk into the room and say, no, 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 maybe. You know, like, you're going to be very self-aware because you're going to see somebody else's energy or somebody else's comments. You're going to know, like, I don't like that way that man talks. talks, or whoa, I'm really interested in him because look at the way he's so thoughtful, and look at the way he tells the story, look what he's talking about. He's not talking about another person, he's talking about his business idea. You know, that's what's in your control.
There was a woman, her father was a rabbi in Chicago, probably in the 40s, and they were, a traditional Jewish home. They were once coming home from, the father was coming home from services and on a Friday night, and a car pulled up. They made a mistake, and it was the mob. They took him out, the father, by mistake. They it was the wrong person. And the wife and the daughter, she was probably 11 or 12 years old then, they were not Chabad Chassidim, but they developed a relationship with the Rebbe as a source of inspiration for them. And the Rebbe became kind of a mentor to her. And the Rebbe followed her and encouraged her in her studies as she went through high school. And then she went to college, and the Rebbe, she was once in an audience with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said to her, "So you're considering marriage?" So she says, I'm open to it, but I haven't found the right guy. So the Rebbe said, "Tell me about the men in your group, in your class, or whatever." And she began to describe each one, and she gave a reason why each one wasn't the right one for her. And then the Rebbe said, "And what about this guy?" So she didn't have anything negative to say. She said, he's not for me. So the Rebbe said, "You have a perception of marriage that you read in your fairy tales, in the novels, right? In the romance novels. You meet the perfect guy, he's your prince, and you ride off into the sunset and you live happily ever after." The Rebbe said, "It's not the way it works. You meet Mr. Charming, but then real life sets in. And when as a couple you work through the challenges of life, then you learn what real love is about." And I'm telling you this story because I believe that every person in this room could be married to tens of thousands of different people. And if they invested in that relationship, they can be happy. Love is an emotion. And that emotion can be replaced for all kinds of different people. We love a lot of things, right? We love our spouses. We love our children.
We love chocolate.
We love chocolate. Love all kinds of things, right? So love is an emotion. Love is an emotion. And if you invest in a relationship with someone who's a good person, you can build a life together. I'm not saying that it's easy to find all those right people, because not everybody who's a nice person is necessarily somebody we're attracted to. And that's Dina's point, that there is somebody that's designated for you. That's why we call it bashert. There is a designated person for each of us. And we have to trust that if we do the right things in terms of making the right decisions and working on ourselves and saying, what's really important to me? What should I be looking for in a person? I would like to have all these other things as well. Those are the bonus. But what are the things that I would like to have? What are the things that are important for me to have? What are the things that really make up a relationship? If I invest in myself and I take the time to see if this person has that, and there's the attraction, and I'm committed to working on a relationship, then it works. And we trust that Hashem brings us together to the right person.
Any other questions? Comments?
And they lived happily ever after. The end. It's made in heaven, it's not lived in heaven.
There's so much here, and so we were talking on the way home last week, like, why it's only two classes. I mean, couldn't this be an 8-week course, a 6-week course? Is there enough material?
We can do this every week if you like.
No, but I mean, is there enough material in Jewish law about relationships to have more than just two classes?
We whet your appetite, so now we're...
Got to wait for part 2.
Oh,
Relationship Seminar Part 2.
You bought the book. She bought the book. See? Aren't you proud of her?
The book.
Good for you. It's a woman of action.
And what was the... Well, you mentioned the theme of that book. You said something like the overall theme is...
It's all about women. It's all that the whole marriage is in the hands of the women. That it's all in her hands. I mean, take that with a grain
right,
of salt.
Is that what, you know, Laura got a book for me many years ago. I think it was called The Care and Feeding of a Husband.
The what?
The
That's from Dr. Laura.
Husband, by Dr. Laura.
Oh, God.
I will tell you a book. I'll give you a book to read for the men. If you would like. It's a very difficult book for the male ego. And he writes in the introduction that he asks women not to read the book, and he blesses women who do not read the book, who I guess are tempted to read the book, with all kinds of blessings. It's called The Garden of Peace. And it was written by a student of a Hasidic master, written originally in the Hebrew.
A student of Rabbi Nachman,
and translated recently into English. And the reason why I say it's a very difficult book to read is because it goes to the core of the male ego. And it demands a tremendous amount of faith and humility, but it is transformative. It's transformative in... I think fundamentally, as much as it's transformative in marriage, it's transformative in one's own development, one's own growth. So,
what's it called?
It's called The Garden of Peace. You can't read it.
Right, that's why I found it interesting that this book, she puts the marriage bonus on the woman.
You'll
but
find
a
guy
who
will
feels like
have it in
Nate. We're doing pretty well, right?
Huh?